Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix, along with Steve Goldstein. Quick check of Valley traffic shows an accident on the 101 southbound in the East Valley at Broadway, blocking the shoulder. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon with a forecast high of 94 degrees. Partly cloudy tonight, overnight lows near 70. A sunny weekend with highs of 92 degrees both tomorrow and Sunday. Right now, under partly cloudy skies, it's 90 degrees.
Surrogates of the presidential nominees have made a habit of stopping by Arizona over the past couple of weeks. Bernie Sanders, Chelsea Clinton, and First Lady Michelle Obama stumped for Hillary Clinton, while Donald Trump Jr. was here for his father. Meanwhile, the candidates themselves will be in the state, as Donald Trump is back again tomorrow, and Hillary Clinton will be campaigning here on Wednesday. That has cemented the claim that Arizona is, in fact, a swing state that is very much in play for November. With me to talk more about that is Thomas Catlaw, an associate professor in ASU School of Public Affairs. He studies political engagement and government. So, Tom, what do all these Arizona visits indicate to you?
Both campaigns are looking at Arizona as being in play. The poll data here certainly suggests that Arizona is perhaps a toss-up, if not leaning Clinton or leaning Trump, depending upon which poll you want to look at. And I think both campaigns are looking at some unconventional roadmaps to victory and looking at states in terms of whether or not they are essential for them in terms of adding up to the electoral votes that they need. And so I think both campaigns are looking at opportunities at an increasingly large number of states that are in play.
And sometimes it's been said of First Lady Michelle Obama as a surrogate that she's almost more popular than Hillary Clinton or even any of the candidates would be at this point. How significant do you think it is that Hillary Clinton herself is actually coming to Arizona next week?
I think it is significant. I mean, I guess the way that I look at this is that I think, you know, the Democrats have looked at Arizona for a long time as being a potential pickup state for them. President Obama did not visit during 2008 and 2012, but he made, you know, 8 visits to the state during his presidency. And as you mentioned, there have been surrogates, Chelsea Clinton, Bernie Sanders, Michelle Obama have been here. And I think probably this is sort of laying the groundwork for a visit from Hillary Clinton herself. I think that the fact that she's coming is an indication that the state is in play and that this is something that the Democrats think they can pick up. And I suspect that the real message from the Clinton campaign is going to be to hardcore supporters to get out the vote and make the most of the last few days of the campaign. So I suspect that the motivation is really to rally the troops to say this is something that's within our reach, so let's go and grab it.
Well, in this increasingly high-tech age and in this age of social media as well, do you think there is less impact generally felt by having candidates make these trips now? We've heard legends of different presidential candidates over the years. Well, over the course of the last week, they visited 47 states and this sort of thing.
Right.
Does that still hold the importance it used to?
You know, I think that there's still something really important about the stumping that candidates do. You know, I think folks are inundated with all sorts of messages from Twitter and Facebook and the news media, radio and television. But there's still something, I think, really powerful about going to a rally, seeing a candidate in the flesh, being around enthusiastic, engaged supporters and thinking, yeah, you know, we can win this. So I think, you know, stumping, even in this digital age, really can have a powerful effect on people who show up at those rallies.
Thomas Catlaw is an associate professor in ASU School of Public Affairs. He studies political engagement and government.
The race for Arizona's Public Utilities Commission can often fly under the radar, but with some major decisions on the horizon, this year's election is particularly close, as KJZZ's Will Stone reports.
battles over solar policy, a quest to uncover the source of dark money, questions of outside influence on commissioners, and efforts to raise electricity bills. This year's election for the Arizona Corporation Commission has no shortage of intrigue. Five candidates are running for three spots. But as it turns out, most voters seem unsure of how they'll vote.
A little over 30% of the entire electorate was still undecided.
Chuck Coughlin is with High Ground, a public relations firm. Their polling shows Republican Andy Tobin at nearly 17%, followed by the two Democrats, Bill Mundell and Tom Chabin, who have been bullish about the alleged influence of dark money in the last election and what they call a culture of corruption created by Arizona Public Service's CEO.
If Chabin or Mundell were to be elected, they would be the only statewide elected Democratic officials.
Republican Bob Burns, who won the primary vote, has been leading the fight against APS over dark money. But he, Tobin, and the final Republican, Boyd Dunn, are enjoying more than $1 million of support from an APS-backed ad campaign in these final weeks.
And they'll represent Arizona taxpayers, not out-of-state special interests.
Those out-of-state interests? National rooftop solar leasing company Solar City, which has poured more than $2 million into the race to support the Democrats and Burns. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
For more than a decade, Congressional District 2 in southern Arizona has been a hard fight down to, at times, less than 200 deciding votes. But as KJZZ's Michelle Marisco reports from the Fronteras desk in Tucson, this year the election is not so hotly contested.
The last time voters cast their ballots in Congressional District 2, it went down to the wire. Current Congresswoman Martha McSally won by 161 votes. 2 years before that, McSally lost her bid against then-Congressman Ron Barber by just 2,500 votes. The district, which runs from Tucson out to the Chiricahua Mountains, is always hotly contested. You wouldn't know that from the outside party money that's barely pouring in this time. McSally.
I had $10 million. Spent against me in 2014. There's not been $1 that has flowed in to support my opponent because they're making business decisions.
Matt Hines is a former state lawmaker and practicing surgeon who's taken up a campaign office inside his brother's internet service company on Tucson Speedway Boulevard. He points to a mid-October slew of Democrats, including Bernie Sanders, who dropped into Tucson after the party declared Arizona a battleground state.
The last 30 days are really the most critical. You can see races like with Congressman Barber, you know, his numbers had them, I think, up 10% 30 days before the election, and that rapidly closes to the point where, as you know, he was down about 1% on the day of the election.
And while the last poll showed McSally far ahead, Hines says the fight isn't over. Michel Marisco, KJZZ News, Tucson.
By the end of the day, Phoenix will have a new police chief. Jerry Williams will be officially sworn in, making her the first woman to lead the department. She's also the first chief to be selected through a new recruitment and hiring process that's attracted the attention of a former London police officer who wants to emulate the process across the pond. KJZZ business correspondent Christina Estes joins me to talk about this. And Christina, what is so special about this process?
The focus on public involvement. Imagine a job interview where you have to sit under bright lights, face hundreds of people, and answer questions submitted by the public. And oh yeah, it's all broadcast live online and on the city's cable channel. That's what the three finalists here faced.
That sounds pretty intense.
Well, the whole process was really detailed, and it started a couple months before the city even advertised the chief's position. They held several public meetings and created an online survey to find out what priorities people wanted the department to focus on and what traits people wanted in their chief. Their responses, which emphasize integrity, accountability, communication and collaboration, led to the actual job description.
So the city got 65 applications. From there, they chose 10 semifinalists. What happened from there?
Well, those candidates faced interview panels, and those panels included city management, union leaders, and community members. Milton Dahoney is the assistant city manager. He oversaw the recruitment and hiring process.
We didn't just include people that are historically fans of the police department. There were people on the interview panels that have had issues with the department.
And he says the candidates did not get softball questions. Now, we didn't get to see those interview panels, but we did see the 90-minute public forum with the three finalists. That's the thing that was broadcast live. Here's a sample of the questions submitted and read by moderator Rick DeBruhl.
The cartoid restraint technique or cartoid artery control technique is a use of force that falls just under lethal force in the City of Phoenix Police Department operation orders. If you become the new chief, would you remove this type of force from all training within the police department? How do you plan to interact with the police union, city council, and civil service review board? As chief of police, what would you do to help an area of businesses that are being ignored by the city that needs to be kept safe and free of blight?
So, Christina, it sounds like a variety of topics were addressed, and this process caught the eyes of a former London police officer who recently visited Phoenix to learn more about this. Can you tell me about that?
Sure. Rory Gagan now runs a nonprofit advocating for what he calls world-class policing. He visited Phoenix to learn more and hopes to generate interest in London.
I think people, once they hear about this way of doing things, I think they'll really go for it. I think, for kind of centuries, people haven't had any kind of sight on this process. It's kind of been that murky world. People haven't known or had any involvement.
In London, it's really the mayor and home secretary who choose the top cop, and then that person is appointed by the queen.
So getting back to Phoenix, city leaders think involving the public is good for the community and the city in terms of transparency and building trust. What about the chief?
Well, she walks in already knowing what the key issues and concerns are. She's heard from city leaders, from labor unions, from residents and business leaders during those interview panels, one-on-one conversations, through that online survey and the public forum. She's also spent the past 3 weeks at headquarters along with her very soon-to-be predecessor, Joe Yonner, so she's had the chance to pick his brain on things that he's picked up over 3 decades of service that aren't necessarily written down somewhere.
So because this process was so public and lasted several months, did anyone say, yeah, this is too much, I'm out?
I know I would have, huh? I asked city manager Milton Dahoney that, especially with that live job interview format. He said no. He said the 3 finalists described the process as exhausting but fair. And Dahoney says he actually got a call from a police administrator in Washington, D.C., who watched that live public forum. One of the finalists was an assistant chief in D.C. Guess what? He is now the chief there, based in part on how he performed during the forum here.
That's KJZZ's business correspondent, Christina Estes. Christina, thanks.
You're welcome.
Arizona has gone Republican in every presidential election since 1952, except for one time when a guy named Clinton narrowly carried the state in 1996. Being so reliably red has led to some complacency, but now with another Clinton on the ballot, Arizona Republicans have a fight on their hands. Polls show Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton virtually tied. And as KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins reports, both parties are spending big to get out the vote.
Until this year, you wouldn't find Arizona and battleground state in the same sentence. For national races, it's historically been a safe space for the GOP. Neither party would admit past complacency, but both Democrats and Republicans here have had record fundraising years, suggesting there's more money being spent on this federal election cycle in Arizona than ever before. State Democrats have raised more than $1.5 million this year, and they're using the money to reach out to voters.
Yeah, everything's all hands on deck right now.
Enrique Gutierrez is the communications director with the state Democratic Party. Democrats have more than 160 paid staffers running 32 statewide offices in Arizona, their largest presence ever in the state. Gutierrez says the National Party helped pay for the expansion.
In other cycles, sometimes our resources are pulled out of Arizona and into, like, you know, states like Nevada or Colorado, where it's very competitive. And now what we're seeing now in this cycle, it's a difference where we're seeing, you know, those resources come into Arizona.
The Democrats are investing heavily in their ground game. Their main focus? Early voting.
We're asking you if you can make mailing in your ballot a priority to make sure that it gets counted on time.
Democrat volunteers like Claudia Hallworth are phone banking in Phoenix to make sure voters that requested early ballots are filling them out and sending them in. More than 2 million Arizonans requested early ballots this year. Hallworth says they have a lot of questions about the relatively new voting method.
What is the deadline for mailing? Can I drop it off at my ballot place? What if I drop it off at a ballot place that's not my ballot place? Will it still count?
Across town at the Republican Party headquarters, volunteers are filling plastic bags with voter information that they'll hang on doorknobs in a neighborhood canvas. Robert Graham is chair of the Arizona Republican Party. He oversees 21 field offices in the state and just over 100 paid staffers.
The reason why that might be perceived as being light here is because the Republican Party has been very self-sufficient, and it takes the pressure off other states.
Graham says even though it's a close race, asking the RNC for money would take away from its efforts in places like Florida and Ohio. He says they've raised more than $3 million in Arizona, and they're spending the majority of it on direct mail and phone calls to get out the vote.
Phone calls, you spend 2 to 3 cents a call. And we've done a million something phone calls, so that gives you a feel for where we are.
And of course, they're spending on digital ads and social media, but there's money going to traditional messaging as well. At this Get Out the Vote event in September, the campaign handed out more than 30,000 yard signs.
Taking this big one home. There you go. I told you it'd fit.
Alex John and his sister are stuffing a massive 4-foot by 8-foot Trump sign into their parents' SUV.
We're gonna hang it up, and we took 10 yard signs, and I'm gonna spread it out with all my family members.
Brian Sychek is the Trump campaign director for Arizona. He says they're investing in everything they can to energize voters.
It's sort of just another indication of the grassroots support. You know, you can purchase television, you can purchase radio, you can purchase digital, but you can't purchase yard signs.
Graham says engaging voters on every level is especially important in a state where voters aren't used to such a tight race.
And so we have to continue to remind them to vote. We have to continue to remind them to engage in the process. But I don't think we have to regroup people just because they become complacent. I think right now people know there's a real fight here in Arizona.
And as the demographics here continue trending younger, more liberal, and increasingly Latino, it's a fight that could bring a hefty price tag for both parties for years to come. Jimmy Jenkins, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
A housing discrimination case out of Yuma may be one with a nationwide impact. It involves a dispute including developers and the rezoning of certain areas and neighborhoods for affordable housing. The Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals had overturned a lower court ruling and has given developers the chance to sue Yuma over a disagreement with concerns about segregation. And earlier this month, the U.S. Supreme Court declined a request to rehear the case. ASU law professor and former U.S. Deputy Solicitor General Paul Bender is with me to explain more of the details. Paul, this had to do with a zoning request by a low-income housing builder that was denied by the Yuma City Council?
The City Council received a whole bunch of comments from a relatively affluent neighborhood right next to where the development wanted to be, saying, don't let them do that. And the things they got did not explicitly mention race, but the message was pretty clear that we think there's going to be a bunch of Hispanics and poor people, and we don't want them living next to us. And the City Council then overruled the Development Commission, or whatever you call it. And so the question before the Ninth Circuit was whether what the city did violated either the Constitution or the Voting Rights Act. And there are two ways that what they did could violate those things. One would be to deliberately discriminate on grounds of race or ethnicity. And the other would be to do something that has the effect of discriminating on grounds of race or ethnicity, even though it may not have been deliberate. The trial court judge threw the case out and said, you can't prove either of those things. And the Ninth Circuit reversed and said, if we take the allegations as true, allegations and complaint as true, then we think they should have a chance to prove both of those things. The lower court had said that it can't, the denial of the permit cannot have the effect of discriminating on grounds of race if there are other housing available in the area that low-income people could use. And the Ninth Circuit said, no, that's not good enough.
So though this particular case specifically only affects Yuma, and the Ninth Circuit covers just a certain number of western states, is this the kind of ruling by the Ninth Circuit and the fact that the High Court declined to take the case? Can this be far-reaching across the country, across the region, this sort of fair housing decision?
Yes, it can, especially if you compare it with what I would have expected to happen 5 years ago, actually what I expected to happen before Justice Scalia left the court. Another circuit had taken a much narrower view of what the Federal Housing Act did. And the Ninth Circuit disagreed with that and took a much broader view of how you can get relief in these circumstances. And there was a conflict in the circuits, and yet the Supreme Court did not take the case. And I view that as the court being more open to broad interpretations of the Federal Housing Act. And if they are going to do that, that could be really important because it's a problem all around the country.
Does this indicate a more progressive direction, even with only 8 members at this point?
I think it does for 2 reasons. One is that Scalia is not there anymore. But the more important reason is that Justice Kennedy has each term been more and more joining with the liberals on the court than with the conservatives. He used to join with the conservatives like 3 out of 4 times. The last 2 terms, he joined with the liberals most of the time. With him changing, you then have, if he is a liberal of any kind, you have 5 liberals on the court now. And if Scalia is replaced by somebody else like Kagan or Sotomayor or Ginsburg, you're going to have a fairly solid six-person liberal bloc on the court, and that would be a big change.
ASU law professor and former U.S. Deputy Solicitor General Paul Bender, we've been talking about a fair housing case out of Yuma.
A booster group for downtown Tucson has a new leader. Kathleen Erickson is the new chief executive officer of the Downtown Tucson Partnership. She took over that job earlier this month after moving to Southern Arizona from Michigan, and she joins me. So, Kathleen, what is it about this job and the area that drew you to Tucson from the Midwest?
Tucson is just so unique, and the people here are very genuine. There's culture, art, food. It's a healthy, vibrant community, and I'm just thrilled to be here.
What do you think ultimately is the potential for downtown Tucson?
I think downtown Tucson is on the precipice of becoming a world-class city, a world-class downtown.
How so?
Well, I mean, like I said, you know, the arts, the culture, it's the city of gastronomy right now, you know, and there's just so much going on. There's all these new developments with the recent development of Caterpillar coming into town. And also we have major sports coming in with the Roadrunners, the hockey Roadrunners. Yeah, it's just there's a lot going on and there's a lot more in the works as well.
Understanding that you've only been on the job for a short time, what are some of the challenges that you see that you'll have to overcome or that the city will have to overcome?
Well, being a large city, there's many times downtowns have more things in common than they do different. With this downtown, some of the challenges might be, you know, the growth and managing the things that come along with growth, making sure that there's enough parking, accessibility, streetscape enhancements. But I don't really see those things as the challenges, but more of opportunities to improve the city. It's all within the realm of possibilities for us to grow right along with the businesses that are being attracted to the area and the new residential growth that we're experiencing as well.
What do you see as the relationship between Tucson and your counterparts in Phoenix?
I see partnerships. I mean, this is a regional area that, you know, when working together, we can only become stronger. There's a lot for each of us to benefit from by partnering together and growing as a region.
In your mind, do you think that Tucson maybe just needs more promotion, both within Arizona and maybe in the broader region, to get people there, more people there, and to sort of tell the city story and let people figure out what's going on down there?
Yes. In fact, you know, Tucson is so unique in the fact that it's a large metropolitan area. Metro Tucson area encompasses 1 million people, and the city itself is 500,000, and that's quite a large city. But when you come to Tucson, what's unique about it is it feels like a small community, and you really feel a part of that community. And I think that's what sets it apart from Phoenix and other larger and same size communities, is that we've been able to retain that small town feel, yet still have all the benefits of a metropolitan area.
There's been a lot of talk, especially in the Phoenix area, about a desire for downtowns in the cities here to be more densely packed and more urban, growing up maybe instead of growing out, which is a bit of a departure from the past in the Phoenix area. Do you get the sense that folks in Tucson are looking for the same thing out of their downtown?
I do think so. I think that we're looking at preserving what we have, also taking undeveloped lots and space and doing infill construction with larger towers. The historic neighborhoods that surround the downtown, restoring all of those beautiful historic structures. So, yes, taking care of what we have and restoring what we have, and then also creating more density and open spaces within the area of the downtown.
Kathleen Erickson is the new CEO of Downtown Tucson Partnership. Kathleen, thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you.
So, Steve, do you like to be scared? I mean, do you like to go to, like, scary movies or haunted houses this time of year?
I like suspenseful movies, Mark. Like, I like Alfred Hitchcock stuff a lot. I don't like the ones where someone's going to come and stab me.
Okay. Well, some people love a good scare. It's why haunted house attractions pop up every year, along with creepy costumes, spooky scenery.
But there is a concern among mental health advocates about how some of those places and costumes depict people with a mental illness. The pushback was enough to close one asylum-themed attraction in California this season.
Now at 5, a popular Halloween attraction at Knott's Berry Farm is shut down over concerns it is hurtful to those who suffer from mental illness.
But the show's Annika Klein found the theme remains popular around Halloween.
For Gail Ayers, the concern started with a costume.
It was called the Gone Mental Costume.
The photo shows a boy in a blood-spattered straitjacket with straps. His arms are tied together, and he stares through dark eye makeup. What really worried Ayers was when her daughter discovered it.
The costume happened to pop up in an advertisement on Facebook. And when she saw it, she looked at me, just stunned, and she said, "Mom, is this supposed to be scary or is it supposed to be funny? Because I'm not scary and this isn't funny."
Ayers' daughter has schizoaffective disorder. And last year, Ayers contacted companies selling the costume, even got a petition going to take it off the market. She says some places removed it, but you can still find it online.
Where it's been discounted on a number of markets. You know, showing up a lot on eBay, Amazon.
Ayers says she's not against Halloween. She's just wary of the way people with a mental illness are being portrayed, whether through this costume or in the asylum-themed attraction at Knott's Berry Farm, which she also petitioned against. She says she doesn't get why the theme keeps popping up each year. But one of the costume company execs she spoke to explained it like this.
We're just supplying a product that people want. He alluded to the fact that a lot of this is driven by Hollywood, by movies and by television.
These are all violent defenders, right? They've hurt people, murdered them in some cases.
In almost all cases, yes.
The asylum has received the Hollywood treatment many times. Sometimes the inmates are the villains, but sometimes they're the heroes.
Jesus, I mean, you guys do nothing but complain about how you can't stand it in this place here, and then you haven't got the guts just to walk out. I mean, what do you think you are, for Christ's sake, crazy or something?
Cuckoo's Nest is not what gets the fun reaction during Halloween. I think what you see at Halloween is much more Nightmare on Elm Street and Freddy Krueger.
That's Patrick Corrigan. He researches stigma around mental illness at the Illinois Institute of Technology. And he says the stigma is getting worse.
Population studies have suggested that the degree to which we'll accept a neighbor or a worker with serious mental illness is getting worse.
He says those negative attitudes toward mental illness spike right after a major event, like a shooting, when the shooter's mental health makes headlines. As for Halloween's influence, that's not so clear. Haunted housegoers might argue it's just fun.
Getting scared has never been so much fun.
The Asylum Haunted House in Denver has been praised as one of the scariest in the country. I tried reaching out to this and other attractions, but all declined to comment for this story. But I did find that not everyone involved in the mental health community is worried. At an event in Phoenix this month, local mental health groups set up booths and talked about the issue of stigma. And Halloween wasn't on the agenda.
Been in the business for over 40 years, and really Halloween hasn't come up around being a problem.
Dick Giesland is CEO of MyKid, a nonprofit focused on youth. And he sees the season as mostly positive for kids who have a mental illness.
So Halloween's kind of a chance for them to cover up, put on costumes, and maybe even hide a little bit, and also pretend like they're somebody else.
Halloween really is a mixed bag of sweet and sour for advocates. But the stigma is something they all want to eradicate year-round. For the show, I'm Annika Klein.
For decades, aging in the U.S. for many people has been associated with leaving the workforce, moving out of their homes, and not driving anymore. But as the average lifespan grows and baby boomers become even more influential, there's a concerted effort to provide more options for seniors and to take advantage of their experience and talent. In a couple of minutes, we'll hear from a local organization connecting seniors to the community. I start, though, with Sue Peschen. She's the president and CEO of the Alliance for Aging Research. Sue, have there been changes in many cases directly because of baby boomers?
Absolutely. The baby boomers are a very active older population. They're very active online. They're very socially aware and socially active. There's 10,000 of them every day, statistically, that are turning 65. So, you know, they're very sort of tuned in to age-related issues, and they vote. So, you know, policymakers care about what they think. In addition to that, you know, folks are aging in a more healthy way than they did 10, 20 years ago. So that the experience of being 60 years old or 70 years old today is very different than it was 20, 25 years ago.
Are there more opportunities now as well? If in the past, if someone was 75, 80 years old and wanted to be an active exerciser, wanted to find more options for healthy food, for example, was it simply not out there as much? And now are there more opportunities being driven by the fact that more people want them? Was it chicken or egg? Was it one of those that as we saw more people aging healthily, companies, businesses, whatnot, thought we need to offer more of these? Or was it the other way around? Did people living longer sort of go out to these businesses and say, hey, how come you're not serving us in the same way?
It's a great observation, and I would say that both are very much true. People did start to, our longevity, we've grown in terms of our average longevity. So that's, been sort of a marker for society, like, okay, we have this burgeoning aging population. And of course, for-profit businesses want to market to them and want to serve them. And then I think at the same time, that population, as they've been sort of more healthy and vibrant at older ages where we were much more sort of frail and had less mobility in earlier generations, they've been able to kind of be more vocal about what their needs are. And I think the baby boom generation and, overall has been vocal throughout the different phases of their life. So this generation in particular has been particularly vocal, and that's been great for everybody.
Are we taking more advantage of the experience level of aging seniors who have a lot to offer in terms of things that they've experienced, whether in the workplace or in the world?
I do think that because you have more of a vibrant population for a longer period of time in the older age groups, that more opportunities have come up over time. There have been some long-standing programs. The AARP has had a financial program to help folks during their annual tax time. So they've had tax advisor programs for quite a number of years. They have Experience Corps, which is sort of a mentoring program for younger kids. And there have been, programs through the American Red Cross and other organizations for quite some time. But they've definitely seen an uptick in the number of folks who have gotten engaged. And it's just, it's because people are healthier as they're getting older, in the last decade or so than they've ever been before. Whether or not there are enough opportunities, I think that's, kind of an open question that remains to be seen. I mean, one of the things that some of the research out of Stanford University has found is that the baby boom generation tends to be less socially connected than previous generations have been. And social connection is, considered to be a marker for healthy aging. And so, we sort of see volunteerism as a way to fill that gap.
Sue Peschen is president and CEO of the Alliance for Aging Research. A number of groups in the Valley are also devoted to offering services and assistance to seniors, in part provided by seniors. With me to talk about that is Melissa Elliott. She's the Vice President of Programs and Services for the Area Agency on Aging in Maricopa County. Melissa, is there a dramatic sea change happening when it comes to opportunities for seniors?
People are living longer, so now we have this really large number of people who have either retired or who are in a later phase of their life but are still very able to give back or want to be engaged in some way. And also because people are living longer, I think the cohort of older adults has gotten huge. So we have everybody from, 65-year-olds all the way up to even 90-year-olds. We have some 80 and 90-year-olds even that volunteer in some of our programs. So that's definitely a change. We see people that are wanting to be out in their community. They want to give back. They want to use the skills that maybe they gained in a professional career in a different way in the community. So certainly the trend in aging services is how can we kind of capitalize on this great resource that we have now as people retire and age, but yet they want to be involved in their community still.
Does it make sense that those would be linked together, this idea that people are living longer, so more people have this kind of experience to offer, and if we have a certain percentage of people who are able to offer it, it would make sense that they'd want to give back in some way.
Yeah, I think it makes sense because obviously people are living longer because they're healthy. So we're not talking about people living longer but being sick. Unfortunately, we have those groups as well. But mostly people live longer and they're healthy and they're active and they're able to volunteer in a variety of different capacities.
So are there more opportunities available then in general for people to do that? I guess are we playing catch up in any way?
I think we are still playing catch up just a little bit, but I think that it's definitely something that is on the radar for a lot of nonprofits and aging network providers. Mm. I know certainly as we go to conferences or we do our own community needs assessment, things like that, we certainly identify the role and the need for volunteers to help us fulfill the mission of our agency. And it's something we hear a lot about or receive training on now, especially as we talk about the, you know, the baby boomers and the projected growth of this population over the next 10 to 20 years.
So what does it take to organize people who come in from, again, maybe you wanted to offer a particular service, but maybe that's not exactly what the agency is looking for at that point? Is it challenging in some way, though, to say, well, this is sort of, we definitely respect what you're bringing, but this is sort of how our system works?
Yeah, I think it's a challenge. I mean, I think as much as possible, we try, you know, we want people to use the skills that they have, but sometimes it just takes good creativity on both sides and flexibility to see what they bring to the table and how it can best fit in with the programs and services that we offer or where we utilize volunteers. But I think, too, as an area agency, we're always open to new ideas as well. If we have somebody that comes and says, hey, I have these skills and I can really offer this, we sometimes can look for a way to see if we can utilize them.
Melissa Elliott is the Vice President of Programs and Services for the Area Agency on Aging in Maricopa County.
If you're looking to grow desert-adapted plants from seed, you can get those seeds tomorrow at the Great American Seed Up. Organizers describe it as a place for farmers and gardeners to collect, preserve, and learn about local seeds. Bill McDormand is executive director of a seed conservation organization called Rocky Mountain Seed Alliance and says the point is to ask people to re-engage in what he calls a ritual that allowed us to start agriculture, especially on this continent.
By growing and saving seeds from the things that work best for us and replanting them, we're grounding our whole, you know, food experience in biology in a way that it just can't be done any other way.
McDormand got interested in seeds more than 30 years ago when he was trying to find them for his own garden. He says most of the cost of seeds is in packaging and distribution, so tomorrow's event will feature seeds in bowls with scoops for attendees to use. In a way, McDormand says it's a return to our roots.
I mean, if you looked around at the turn of the century, every gardener and every farmer that was in Arizona and throughout this country saved seeds. It was just part and parcel of what you did. You took advantage of this adaptability to make sure things were better.
Many of the seeds that'll be available tomorrow are for edible plants, but the effort to collect seeds extends beyond the salad bowl. For that perspective, I'm joined by Steve Blackwell, Conservation Collections Manager at Desert Botanical Garden, and Kimberly McHugh, Program Director for Conservation of Threatened Species and Habitats at the Garden. And Kimberly, let me start with you. Can you tell me about some of the seed conservation efforts DBG has been undertaking?
So the Desert Botanical Garden has been working on seed collecting of native plants for many, many years. In fact, the garden is a founding member of an organization called the Center for Plant Conservation. And the initial efforts of the Center for Plant Conservation, or CPC, were focused on collecting seeds and banking them as what we call a backstop against extinction. And that started in 1984. And since then, we've really broadened our scope. And we are collecting seeds of both rare plants and of more common plants that would be really useful in restoration efforts in the desert.
What do you do with these seeds once you collect them?
We do a lot of different things with these seeds. So one of the things is banking them. And that essentially means putting them into cold storage, which helps them persist or survive for much longer than if we just let them, you know, lay around on a desk. But we also do a lot of other kinds of research with the seeds. So particularly with rare plants, we know so little about the life history of these plants and how to grow them. And we need to know how to grow them so that if we have an opportunity to restore them back to the wild, we can actually get them from the seed stage to a mature plant. And then we also are embarked on a program now that's about a year and a half, 2 years in the making, where we're doing what we call seed increase of milkweed plants. And this is related to our efforts with monarch conservation at the garden.
Steve, what is the significance of this effort? I mean, why is it important that there's this giant room filled with tons and tons of seeds?
Well, I mean, the main part is conserving the biodiversity of these plant species.
How many seeds of some of these rare plants do you actually have? Like, do you have to be careful with experiments that you do on them? Like, you don't want to drop it down a drain or something like that because, like, you'll just, that's it.
Absolutely. So one of the issues that we have is particularly when we're collecting rare seeds, we have to be very cognizant about how many seeds we take out of a population because we don't want to do any, you know, detrimental harm to a population. So we limit it to about 5% of any viable seeds from any population at any given time. So we don't take any more than that because we don't want to harm the population. So when we collect the seeds, you know, we are always, usually, depending on the species, you're usually working with a very small seed lot. And so we have to be very, very conscientious about how many of these seeds that we use. So we do it very sparingly. And with germination tests, it all depends on how many seeds that we have of these species. So we have to be very careful about how many we use.
Has Desert Botanical Garden ever been in a situation where it's lost a plant for whatever reason and it was an extinct or close to extinct plant and you've had to go into this bank to take a seed and propagate it to put it back out into the garden for public view?
So we actually have internally what we call a red list, and we monitor quarterly our collection. And what we're looking for is, are there any species of plant in our collection that we only have one or two individual plants of? And when we see those on that red list, if you will, then we develop a plan to get those numbers back up. Because if you've only got one or two plants, oh my gosh, you know, anything can happen, right? And so one of the things, when we have those plants on a red list, we look to see, do we have seeds of that species in our seed bank? And if we do, that's the first place we go to, is we pull some seeds out and we try to propagate those plants to get the number of living plants of a given species back up.
Does it ever happen where you take a seed from your seed bank and you plant it and you cultivate it with the purpose of being able to produce a plant from which you can just get more seeds and sort of build up your stock?
Yeah, absolutely. Kim was referring to the red list species that we have. And one of the projects that I'm working on, well, one of the species that I'm working on is a rare cactus. And we don't have any living specimens at the garden at all. So I've grown some out from seed. And from those seeds, I'll be able to grow them out to maturity. And when they flower, I can actually hand pollinate them to assure that they are, you know, genetically cross-pollinated with each other and not with other closely related species.
Is there actually, like, a room at DBG that is this bank? Like, do you have a giant room somewhere that's very cold that has a lot of seeds in some kind of container?
So currently we have a seed freezer, and it's at -4 degrees Fahrenheit or -20 Celsius. So basically everything is stored in that. And really the storage at that temperature is for medium to long-term storage. What that does is, by freezing them, you reduce the temperature down and the metabolic rate goes way down on these seeds so they can live longer. So we don't currently have a huge room, but everything we have, our 4,000 seed collections that we have, are stored in a -20 Celsius freezer.
Steve Blackwell is Conservation Collections Manager at Desert Botanical Garden. We also heard from Kimberly McHugh, the garden's Program Director for Conservation of Threatened Species and Habitats. Trick-or-treaters won't be alone in the search for sweet snacks this Halloween.
Here's a warning. Anyone who decorates the outside of their home with real pumpkins might be visited by wild animals in search of food. We like this story so much, we wanted to celebrate Halloween by dressing up in our costumes and listening again to this story. As Steve Shadley reported, these bumps in the night aren't just your two-legged neighborhood rascals.
Halloween wouldn't be complete without a traditional jack-o'-lantern, so this week I bought a medium-sized, slightly lopsided pumpkin to decorate my home. I grabbed a carving tool and got down to work, careful not to lose a finger.
My knife's not very sharp. Wow, it smells great. Now I'm grabbing all of the gooey, stringy stuff out of the inside of the pumpkin.
Finally, my jack-o'-lantern is finished. I wanted to put the pumpkin outside to decorate the walkway to my house, but wildlife officials say it could attract animals.
Hi, I'm Darren Julian, Urban Wildlife Specialist for Arizona Game and Fish Department, Region 6.
Julian and I met outside of his office in Mesa. We walked about 100 yards away from the building to the edge of the desert in hopes of finding some wildlife. This is where you might see one critter with a healthy appetite for pumpkins, the peccary, better known in these parts as javelina.
These javelina are following their nose, and if you've got a pumpkin out there that they can smell, they're going to find it.
Javelina look like a wild pig, but Julian says they aren't related. However, javelina do have a pig-like snout. They have coarse, bristly hair, and the older ones even have sharp, tusk-like teeth. Usually, javelina eat barrel cactus and plant roots, but when Halloween arrives, sometimes they march out of the desert into the neighborhoods.
We do see them use a lot of these natural washes as travel corridors. For example, Indian Bend Wash in Scottsdale, and the javelina have come off of McDowell Mountains, pushed their way through there, and we've actually got javelina on Camelback Mountain, for example.
I've even seen javelina in the city limits. About 20 years ago, a friend and I were hiking Phoenix South Mountain, and we ran into a small herd of the animals. They came out of nowhere, and before we knew it, they surrounded us with their noses in the air, trying to smell us. Javelina don't see too well, and after a few minutes, they walked on by like we weren't there. So yeah, they are around urban areas, and Arizona Game and Fish hears citizen complaints, especially around Halloween.
Probably more than anything, they're probably calling the police saying, you know, hooligans or kids are out there destroying pumpkins. That's not always the case. Some areas, it's probably the javelina that are coming in and tearing up the pumpkins and making quick food of them.
Arizona Game and Fish reminds us that it's illegal to feed wild animals in some parts of the state. Violators could receive a fine. Besides, javelinas can be mean and aggressive.
When they are agitated, you'll see them clicking their teeth and stuff, though. You know, I mean, popping their teeth. I mean, like... But also, you know, the sounds for, like, to warn the others is they almost like a, I call like a woof sound. Woof, woof, woof.
If you spot javelina while you're camping or they show up in your yard, make a loud noise to scare them off. Julian says pepper spray is also effective and it won't hurt them. So when you're walking around in the dark tonight and you hear this noise,
woof, woof, woof,
it could be a ghost, a witch, maybe a werewolf, but it might just be a javelina looking for a piece of tasty pumpkin. Happy Halloween, everyone.
That's public radio host, the iconic one, Steve Shadley.
Now, Steve, as you know, Halloween isn't the only fall classic on people's minds right now.
Yeah, Mark, tonight Wrigley Field in Chicago will host a World Series game for the first time in 71 years. You've probably heard at least a little bit about the Cubs' history, one that has made them baseball's lovable losers, as they haven't been World Series champs since 1908.
So a special correspondent, a very special correspondent, has made it to the Windy City for tonight's game between the Cubs and Cleveland Indians, Mary Lou Goldstein, Steve's mom. Earlier, he reached her in her Chicago hotel room.
Hello.
Hi, Mom. All right, Mom, so how long have you been a Cubs fan?
Over 60 years.
Okay, and when did you start going to Wrigley Field? Do you remember your first early memories of that?
I started when I was about 10 years old. My father used to take me to the Sunday doubleheaders, and we would go for the day, and it was a wonderful day always, win or lose, more lose than win.
Before I was born, there was a time when it looked like there was going to be the magic season. That was 1969. So what was that like?
Well, first of all, we went from Chicago to Arizona to spring training for the first time in our lives. Saw the team, thought they were great. We followed them through the season, and as Labor Day hit, we were so excited that they were letting people order tickets for the World Series, I guess they called them in those days. Anyway, and I took my firstborn son to the bank. He had to send in a certified check, and off it went, and we waited. And we waited till now. Because the Mets overtook the Cubs, and they never made it. Deep sigh.
So did you ever think you would see this?
Nope. In fact, I always said I'd live till the Cubs won the World Series. So frankly, I'm a little bit nervous, but joyful.
You arrived yesterday. So what's the atmosphere been like?
Oh, it's electric. Everywhere you go, everybody's got their Cub shirt on. Everywhere you go, there's Cub logos. Doesn't make any difference. The Art Institute has the Lions, you know, with Cub logos on that.
Good luck to the Cubs and to you, obviously. I hope you have a great time, and thanks for talking to me on the radio. It's the first time we've ever done this.
It's always a joy to talk to you.
Obviously, the same goes back to you, Mom. Thanks.
Let me hear you. That's
the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.